All right, so going down or up one series in the periodic table, this will be about correlation effects in the compressed rare earths, and I would like to also thank the organizers for inviting me to talk at this workshop and acknowledge my collaborators, Karsten Held and Richard Skalatar. And much of the work I'll talk about is covered in those references. The basic problem in the rare earths can be seen by looking at the pressure volume data of the trivalent rare earths. And every time these symbols change from filled to open, there's a first order structural phase transition, so they're a dime a dozen, yet three of them stand out with huge 9 to 15% volume changes. Moreover, the structures below the collapse transitions here are all high symmetry, basically stacking variants of HCP or FCC, and the structural sequences down here are seen in metals that have no F electrons like yttrium. Above the collapse, one has low symmetry structures characteristic of the actinides, and it is believed that these transitions are due to F electron correlation effects, and there are two models which deal with this, the Mott transition model of Johansson et al., the Kondo volume collapse of Allen and Martin and Lavagna et al., specifically aimed at cerium. And I will touch on those models during the course of the talk as I present results. For a matter of convenience, I'm going to refer to the large volume phases as localized and the small volume phases as itinerant, as that's the common language, but I don't mean to imply anything about the degree of correlation and the itinerant phases, which will be one of the issues of the talk. There's additional information from one atmosphere pressure results, and this comes because the valence electrons that cause the binding may be viewed as confined between an ion core radius and a volume per atom, and pressure squeezes the outer one, causing compression. But as Johansson and Rosengren noted some years ago, if you move from the right to the left across the rare earths or actinides, the size of the ion core effectively increases. Thus you have this localized behavior in the late actinides and then the collapse to plutonium, which Sergey was talking about. And you have a consistent sort of parabolic behavior here as seen in the transition metals. The rare earths are more like the late actinides, excepting the two divalent members, which I will ignore for the rest of the talk. Another feature to note is has to do with magnetic moments, and the localized phases from praseodymium on in the rare earths or the late actinides have paramagnetic or saturation magnetic moments which agree pretty closely with the free ion values, which are the drawn curves, whereas the early actinides show a temperature-independent magnetic susceptibility consistent with the absence of a moment or a moment that's screened. It might also be noted that simple one-electron concepts do capture some of these differences. If you have a narrow F-band broadening symmetrically about an atomic energy level, if it's either full or empty, there's no change in energy. However, if it's less than half-filled, you can see that the average energy will bend down. And if you integrate that over this density of states, you get a binding contribution which is parabolic in the filling. And that has been taken as justification for this kind of behavior. On the other hand, if you look at Hartree-Fock and its treatment of the Coulomb interaction at large volume, and you subtract off this rather benign piece, which LDA does so well, you're left with an expression which sums over the orbitals and is minimized for sharp orbital occupations, that is to say, one or zero. And the effect of this term at large volumes, where this term dominates, is to polarize the bands. Hartree-Fock will do this, for example, so that you have an integer number that are completely filled below. And so with the capacity and the filling identical, it loses this binding effect, whereas the bands that have been picked have a particular spin and magnetic quantum number. There's some suggestion of a moment, although, of course, this is a broken symmetry, which is a problem. At the other hand, in the itinerant regime here, you basically feel that at some point in the Brillouin zone, more or less any orbital will get some states towards the bottom of the band, and so you have really no characteristic moment. These two extremes are in fact correct at very, very large volume and very, very small volume. And so the real issue is, what does correlation do in the more interesting region in the vicinity of the transitions? Now, I'm still presenting data, and this is going to be a way of looking at it that would be dear to the heart of an LDA person. If there's some difference between the F binding, let's do a normal LDA calculation with all electrons, including F, in the valence, and those are the curves on the left in each case. If you want to get rid of the binding, you don't want the Fs to hybridize with the other states. A simple trick that LDA people do is treat it as a core state. That is to say, the wave function exists only in the Wigner-Seitz sphere, and you terminate it with some band center boundary condition, and then the valence states only have SP and D momentum, angular momentum. Now, I don't claim, these are the dash dot curves on the right, I don't claim there's any meaning or truth to these, but I use them as a template against which to look at the experimental data. And one of the first points you see is that above the collapse, normal LDA is doing pretty well. That's clear here for cerium, and here for praseodymium in the alpha uranium structure, and here for neodymium, also in the alpha uranium structure. And neodymium is quite interesting because there was a recent experimental paper by Chestnut and Vora who compressed up to this point. They say, aha, we see no collapse, yet we've reached the alpha uranium structure, which is what praseodymium went to. Therefore, there is no collapse in neodymium. And the LDA person would agree entirely because they would say, yep, it's now agreeing with normal band theory. It's a normal metal. There was no collapse. So there's a suggestion that in general the phenomenon that's going on in the rare earths and possibly the actinides as well is got a continuous aspect to it, which is sometimes interrupted with these volume collapses. And evidence would be neodymium. Here's gadolinium, where there's a collapse and yet it's still nowhere near regular LDA. And then there was a paper on americium, an experimental diamond anvil work in the last 2 years by a French group, which observed that it has two collapse transitions, one of 2% and one of 6%. So maybe this phenomenon is more complicated than we think. As long as we're noting that LDA does fairly well above the collapse, let me show you some structural results by Per Soderlund. This is the C over A ratio in cerium and thorium. Now, I've used a kilobar scale here, and 10 kilobars is a GPA, so this is really magnified, and the agreement for cerium is comparable to thorium. And so this is just showing that, look, this is really detailed structural stuff where the theory is saying that the C over A is beginning to increase over FCC and then is stabilizing at a value. And so there's some precise stuff coming out of LDA. And one of the dilemmas will be that all of the new dynamical mean field results are saying that these phases up in here are still strongly correlated. So if that's the case, why is LDA doing so well? And I have no answer. That will be one of the points to be made in the talk, simply the dilemma. So let me turn to theory. And what I'm going to do is contrast mean field with a correlated treatment. And I'm going to define mean field as when you have a particular K vector and band index, you have a sharp energy. That is to say, you've got as many bands as you've got orbitals in the repeating cell. So for 6s, 6p, 5d, and 4f, which is true for the rare earths, you would have 16 bands. Hartree-Fock has this characteristic. Even though there's some correlation effects in density functional theory, it shares this characteristic, as does the modified LDA technique, self-interaction corrected LDA plus U and orbital polarization. What I'm going to define as correlated is where you can get a width to these bands or structure, a multi-peaked structure is seen here. And in order to do that, you have to have a spectral function. And so the mean field treatment, the spectral function, is a delta function. Or another quantity I could talk about would be the self-energy, which is a constant matrix here, and down here it has both frequency and K dependence. Examples of correlated treatments would be configuration interaction, quantum Monte Carlo, and then of course the wonderful new dynamical mean field theory, which is based on the realization that in many strong correlated materials, the critical correlation comes from the frequency dependence, and so you can throw away the K dependence, making it much cheaper. And thus we have dynamical mean field theory and a bit of a linguistic problem, which then maybe we would have to refer to the normal mean field as static mean field. LDA does well, as I've noted, for the small volume itinerant regime of the rare earths. A correlated treatment is imperative for the large volume and the collapse, and I'll be making that point. And in the case of the rare earths, it would be prohibitive to do a fully correlated treatment with the spatial dependence. And so dynamical mean field theory is the perfect answer. What you throw away with the K dependence is, for example, magnetic order. And the rare earths have magnetic order generally well below room temperature, which is the region in which we're interested in the data. So a little bit about LDA plus dynamical mean field theory, which is also what we're using. The LDA part is simply to generate an effective Hamiltonian. One does at every volume a self-consistent solution for the material of interest, and then basically takes the one electron Hamiltonian matrix as defining the one body part of an effective Hamiltonian. And then you explicitly add on the Coulomb interaction for the species that are to be strongly interacting. Because the LDA eigenvalue has bits of average Coulomb effects buried in its site energy, one should remove that and replace it by a bare site energy. And then all of this becomes the one body part H sub zero. The bare site energy and the Coulomb interaction we get from separate self-consistent constrained occupation calculations. Here are such calculations of U for cerium. It's generally on the order of 6. This is a huge volume range. It's a factor of 5 compression. So you can see the U changes in a very modest way. The pluses here are bracket the transition. So it's maybe 10 or so percent change in U. Whereas what I haven't said is that the hybridization buried in this term changes by far more than an order of magnitude over this volume range. So it's really the active term. Now, the dynamical mean field theory is used to solve that effective Hamiltonian. You guess the self-energy, calculate the lattice Green's function, average over all K to get a local quantity, and then we go a little bit further and average over all 7 F orbitals to get a single representative F Green's function, and then we remove the self-energy, which is done with a plus sign since it's a minus there. And this becomes then a quantity that defines an auxiliary impurity problem, in which you have a single F site with its 7 orbitals strongly interacting, and then also having a coupling to a bath of degrees of freedom around, which is given by G0. You can solve this exactly within numerical uncertainties by quantum Monte Carlo, which is what we use, and at very large volume or high temperature, the Hubbard 1 is a cheaper alternative. When you solve, you get the new impurity model Green's function, you combine it with the input to get a new self-energy, and then you iterate to self-consistency. I should acknowledge the approximations we make, scalar U, no intra-atomic exchange. The local self-energy is, of course, the dynamical mean field approximation. Our scalar self-energy means a scalar times a 7x7 identity, and as yet we don't have spin orbit. The thermodynamics come just by, you can use the one body part of the Hamiltonian, the Green's function, to get the kinetic energy. This is just an expectation of the Coulomb operator. One of the virtues of having an effective Hamiltonian with a finite number of degrees of freedom is that you can go in temperature well above those where you know the high temperature limit of the entropy, and then using that you can integrate a derivative of the energy back down to get an entropy for the dynamical mean field calculation. For the total energy, including all electrons, the approach we use is simply to take the LDA result, add to it the dynamical mean field result for the valence electrons, and then subtract off a model solution, an LDA-like or model LDA solution of the same effective Hamiltonian. And that's one that has a familiar self-energy, which is just U times the number of F electrons minus a half. And there's the potential energy. I'm going to be, after this view graph, showing results, but I want to compare results that include correlation and those that don't, so we can solve that same effective Hamiltonian with Hartree-Fock. And this is what a Hartree-Fock solution looks like. As I noted at very large volume, that Hartree-Fock treatment of the Coulomb interaction will split off, in the case of cerium, a single band. And then this solution, as you compress, eventually becomes unstable to the paramagnetic solution, where all 14F bands group just above the Fermi level. There's still about an average of one F electron. These gross characteristics are shared by all of the modified LDA techniques, self-interaction corrected, LDA plus U, and orbital polarization. They all behave the same way. And therefore, I would think that they all have the same problems, which can be resolved by a correlated treatment, which is a multi-peak spectral function. The first is the broken symmetry. You've picked a spin and a magnetic quantum number, and that has real bad implications for the entropy. In fact, using a multi-peak spectral function, what you do is you have bits and pieces of all 14 bands down here that accommodate one electron, and then the remaining up here, and it retains its rotational invariance, and that will, we will see shortly, has important implications for the entropy. A second point is that the mean field transition is rather catastrophic. It goes by collapsing these bands together just over the Fermi level. And if you have a multi-peak spectral function, you can do something more continuous. You can grow slowly spectral weight here at the Fermi level in the presence of the Hubbard splitting. And in fact, experimental data and all of these correlated solutions, such as the one that Sergi showed, show just such behavior. So now I'm going to begin with numerical results. And I have a very small amount for praseodymium, but I thought what I'd do is a consistent story on cerium. And then put the small amount of praseodymium at the end. This is a correlation energy defined as the energy relative to paramagnetic Hartree-Fock. And what I want to look at first is the Hartree-Fock itself, the polarized Hartree-Fock, which is this blue dash dot curve. And it does give a good energy at low temperature and large volume. And then as you compress, I showed you the view graph of the bands. Well, here's where the energies cross, and it becomes the paramagnetic solution becomes the stable one. And you'll see that this occurs at a volume that's far smaller than the observed range of the alpha-gamma transition. Another point to make is just a numerical one. This cheaper Hubbard 1 agrees very well with the quantum Monte Carlo self-energy treatment at high temperature and large volume. So that's a real aid and getting broad expansive results. To summarize the rigorous dynamical mean field quantum Monte Carlo treatment, the best way is to compare it to the polarized Hartree-Fock. And what you do see is that as you compress, it pulls away, and it does so more dramatically and at larger volume as you lower the temperature. And this breakaway occurs roughly in the vicinity of the observed transition. And it carries with it a negative curvature. And this negative curvature, or negative bulk modulus, could be a source for introducing a van der Waals loop, and thus the first order phase transition. I'm going to talk a little bit here about temperature dependence at a large volume, again, to contrast the mean field with the correlated treatment. So I'm showing the energy. Let's look at the Hartree-Fock again in blue. As I come down in temperature, I undergo a spurious phase transition from the paramagnetic to the polarized, in which I simultaneously form a magnetic moment and magnetic order. Those two things are intimately connected in Hartree-Fock. As I go to lower temperature, You notice that the energy is very good, which I observed on the previous few graph. And the reason for that is that one of the Hund's rule multiplet states is a single Slater determinant. And therefore, Hartree-Fock is able to get the large volume, low temperature energy right, that is polarized Hartree-Fock. But because of the Boken symmetry, it butchers the entropy. So the entropy here is basically zero, and we will see momentarily that it should be something quite different. Now let's look at the dynamical mean field. You come down here, there's no transition, yet something is happening because the entropy is beginning to plateau at log 14. This is really log 2j plus 1. This is the directional degeneracy of the moment. And since we don't have spin orbit, instead of having 6, we have the full 14. But the point is, this is indication of the formation of the moment. We know that at low enough temperature, the entropy must go to 0. Crystal field effects are known to drop the entropy. And if there were any magnetic order in cerium, it would be way down here. The point is that magnetic moment and magnetic order are two distinct phenomena in the correlated treatment. And it is the moment that is key to the rare earth collapse transitions and not magnetic order. Here's a schematic of a phase diagram showing the path that we just took. Temperature, volume. Here's this phase line in static mean field, which stabilizes at U over 4. And when you go through this, you form both the moment and you magnetically order. A true correlated solution, this of course would require intersite correlations. One knows that the region of magnetic order goes down as T squared over U, and so is way down there. Now in the dynamical mean field theory, we don't get any magnetic order because we have no K dependence on the self energy, but I've indicated here that room temperature lies above the region of magnetic order, and in general well above. So now I'm going to go back to the volume dependence. And it again is most convenient to compare the dynamical mean field results to the polarized Hartree-Fock. They're in good agreement. So, and again, this is the total energy, the all electron energy. They're in good agreement at large volume. But as we lower the temperature, notice that the dynamical mean field is pulling further and further away from the polarized Hartree-Fock to the extent that it creates a shallowness down here, which is consistent with the quantum Monte Carlo error bars with the extrapolated zero temperature phase transition pressure. Now, in fact, we believe this lowest temperature, which is about 600 Kelvin, is already near the low temperature limit in energy. And the reason for that is we have done quantum Monte Carlo calculations at half the temperature, and they agree at the same finite time slice. But it's too costly for us to extrapolate the 300 Kelvin result to zero, so all we have is a suggestion. This was a point that Sergi made, that the phonon contributions we've left out, but they're really not important here because they're comparable on both sides of the transition as observed by Johansson et al. Here's the corresponding entropy. Here's our plateau, the degeneracy of the moment, and again our bad log 14 instead of log 6. And then as one crosses through the observed alpha GaN of a transition, the entropy drops like a bat, which would be consistent with the moment being screened or going away in some other way. And I will note that momentarily I'll show you the spectrum in which in this same range the Abrakosoff-Sewell or central resonance is growing at the Fermi level. It wouldn't be complete to show the without showing the free energy, though our error bars are so large. All I can really say is that we're consistent with experiment. What's been done here is if our 600 Kelvin energy is really close to the low temperature limit, I've used it here as a pseudo zero temperature free energy, and then I added the entropy term to that same energy to get a 632 result, and then here's one at 1580 Kelvin. And the lines here are the experimental transition pressures, and they are consistent. But again, we would have to get, we can make no claim of seeing a van der Waals loop. We really have to get our error bars way down and get the right entropy at large volume to say that such a plot is unequivocal demonstration of the transition. So now here's the spectra. And what you see at large volume is Hubbard splitting, as you expect, which is a signature of the moment. And then as you compress, you begin to get a small central resonance, and already here, which is essentially the gamma volume, you're getting this small resonance at the Fermi level. It shoots up like a bat by the alpha phase. And then even to the smallest volumes we go, where the central resonance is really dominating and beginning to look like LDA, we still see residual Hubbard sidebands. In other words, there's still some suggestion of correlation. I mean, this is really high pressure. This is like 200 GPA in one of those early plots that I showed you. This just shows the specific heat and the very nice correspondence of the growth of this Abrikosov-Sewell resonance in a low temperature peak. If you first began to see this here, you'll notice this is, by the way, a log plot. There's just a bit of a little bump here. And then by the alpha phase, this has gotten very pronounced. And then it broadens and shifts to higher temperatures as one compresses. This is the temperature dependence of the spectra. And one can make an estimate of the Kondo temperature from the half width, or full width at half maximum of this peak, which is at 600 Kelvin. This gives something like 2000 Kelvin. The higher temperature is comparable to that, so it's not surprising that the peak is very broadened out. And if one compares with experiment, this 2000 Kelvin would compare with photo emission results by Liu et al. Of 945 and high energy neutron scattering results somewhere in the vicinity of 1800 and 2000 Kelvin. In the gamma phase, both of our temperatures are well above the estimated Kondo temperatures, and so the peaks are, of course, quite broadened out. This is a comparison of the full spectra to the experimental data. We do a good job at the Fermi level, and the largest disagreement is the width of the upper peak here, and we note that this F2 level would benefit from intra-atomic exchange and spin orbit to get the multiplet structure, which would broaden that out somewhat. So that's probably an important source of error in that. There are a few other diagnostics for the phenomenon in Sirium. And they are, for example, the number of F electrons in the double occupation as defined by this expression. Generally speaking, the number of electrons goes up as you heat because of this empty F density of states above the Fermi level. They go up as you compress because the 6s and 6p levels tend to rise relative to the Fermi level as you compress. Those are the gross behaviors. And then superimposed on that is a drop in the number of electrons across the number of F electrons across the transition, which coincides with an increase in the double occupancy. And since the repulsive energy is UD, one way you could ameliorate that cost in energy is actually convert some of your F electrons to valence. Now, we talk about a fractional number of F electrons, but at any instant and on any site, there is an integer number. And what one can do is, since for cerium, it's unlikely that you're going to ever have three or more on a given site, these two numbers are sufficient to define the fractions of sites which instantaneously have zero F electrons, one or two. Now, at very large volume, without any hybridization, roughly one F electron, there's going to be one F electron on every site, because if they tried to do anything else, they'd double up, and that would have a double occupancy penalty. And indeed, you see that the F1 population is basically one, and the other two are basically zero. If you have decreasing volume and you get fluctuations, one of the F electrons may hop into a neighboring valence site or vice versa. Or if you had hopping directly between F orbitals, if you had two near neighbors, and one could hop to this one, doubly populating that F orbital. In either case, the effect of hybridization should be to increase the number, the fraction of sites with zero and no F electrons and two versus one. And I simply noticed that in our calculations, these changes are fairly dramatic across the range of the observed transition. You can use the double occupancy to try to define the degree of electron correlation. What you do is you pick a limit that you know is uncorrelated. Let's go to V equals zero, where the hybridization is infinite. You have a free electron gas. Then you know that the expectation of this product of number operators is going to be equal to the product of the expectations. And if our F states, all 14 are roughly equally filled, we'd get something like this. If I plug that in, I get this dashed curve shown here, which will turn out to be a maximum. A strongly correlated limit you can easily get by going to infinite volume and zero temperature. And there you can solve the model exactly, and you get a piecewise linear expression for the double occupancy, which is shown here and which will turn out to be a minimum. We could therefore insert our calculated double occupancy in a ratio which would produce one if you had strong correlation and zero if you had weak correlation, and that's what's done here. And I want to first examine the Hartree-Fock transition. At large volume, where you have that polarized solution, the ratio is one, it's strongly correlated, and then here's the transition to the paramagnetic solution, which is basically uncorrelated. So this is the intuitive idea behind the Johansson view of the Mott transition. It is a transition from a strongly correlated material, bang, to a weakly correlated material. And this does that, but unfortunately, again, it's a volume that's way away from the observed range. And if you look at the more rigorous correlated treatment, the dynamical mean field, you find some rapid change in the vicinity of the transition. But even to the largest volumes that we go to, the value of this ratio is still over 0.5. So it's still strongly correlated. And this coincides with the fact that there were those Hubbard sidebands that persisted even to these very, very small volumes. Now the magnetic moment. Our treatment, we basically treat all 14 F orbitals as more or less the same, and so an expectation of the number operators like this basically only gives two answers depending on whether the states are identical or different. And if you take that approximation, you can relate the expectation of S squared, in other words, the magnitude of the spin moment, the magnitude squared of the angular momentum moment, to a simple expression, mz squared, which is a simple generalization of what the one-band Hubbard people have used for years. It's basically the up operator minus the down operator squared, and then you average. And our difference is then we sum over m. And I want to repeat that the rare earth collapse transitions are about the moment, which is mz squared, whether what happens to it. Does it change in size? Does it stay large? Is it screened? And not about magnetic order. And the static mean field calculations really are measuring not mz squared, but mz. That's their polarization. That's their magnetization. That's their magnetic order. And when they talk of a transition, what happens is they're calculating mz and they go through the transition and it collapses to zero. That's just saying they've lost magnetic order. It doesn't say anything about what happened to the moment. In our particular results, the moment does change very slightly across the range of the transition, and then this increase up here is nothing more than mimicking the behavior of the number of F electrons. Back to this issue of whether you could get rid of the moment, we could, in fact, note that it's very hard to get rid of a moment. We could put in an uncorrelated value for this double occupancy, which is the maximum value, and you get an expression which is basically zero only if the F band is full or empty. Otherwise, if you just scatter the F electrons in these states, you're going to have some kind of a moment. And so then the question is, in the itinerant regime, we know there's temperature-independent magnetic susceptibility. How do you get that in the presence of a moment? Well, one way is Kondo screening, a correlated effect where the valence electrons are screening this F electron moment. And since we find strong correlation on the itinerant side of the transition, this would appear to be the dominant mechanism. But it must also be admitted that the original Pauli argument for temperature-independent paramagnetic susceptibility works in the free electron limit. And it is really that you got this continuous band of electrons and only some range near the Fermi level can respond to the field. And so there is another way of getting Pauli temperature-independent paramagnetism. And as we go off towards V equals zero, sooner or later, that does become more important. Finally, we could use this mz squared ratio to define the degree of correlation in the same way, but it's just the same trick all over again with d min and d max. And in fact, the curve you get is precisely the one I showed you on the other plot. So here you have the strong correlation, and then even at the smallest volumes, still rather significant correlation. All right, so I have this little bit more. I'm going to switch to praseodymium. This is the same correlation energy I showed previously for cerium. It's energy relative to the paramagnetic Hartree-Fock results. And one difference I would like to point out right away in terms of the Hartree-Fock is that in all of the calculations we do with Hartree-Fock on these effective Hamiltonians, something interesting happens. In the case of praseodymium, you've got two F electrons, so two bands are split off. When you go from polarized to paramagnetic, you don't pop up two bands. You pop up one at a time. And so you go from this blue solid curve, which has two bands down, to this one where you have one band down, and then finally to the truly paramagnetic solution. Now, this is a spurious effect that there's no evidence whatsoever in experiment, and I would be real interested to hear comments from LDA plus U people and self-interaction corrected people in their calculations for praseodymium, what they find in that regard. A second point is all related to the fact that praseodymium is more strongly correlated than cerium at a given volume. We knew that because it has a larger U, that F band is sucked down by the extra core charge, and so it's got a narrower bandwidth. And you see evidences of that here. You'll notice that when the dynamical mean field bends away from the polarized solution, it's at smaller volume, more like 24 here than say 28 here. Another thing you notice is that the atomic limit Hubbard 1 and the quantum Monte Carlo are agreeing very closely here for these temperatures, where for the identical temperatures over here, the agreement wasn't so good. And then a final point to note is that these two curves are not that different, suggesting that already even this may be close to a low temperature limit, so a higher low temperature limit. All of this consistent with the fact that praseodymium is more strongly correlated at the same volume than cerium. And then this is just more of the same. It's the only one in which I have neodymium, and it's only the Hubbard 1 calculation. But I can just reiterate the three points. Here, this curve here going up here has got three bands polarized below the Fermi level. It pops up one, then it pops up the other, and so on, which is totally unphysical. And then the other thing is to note that the bend away of the dynamical mean field theory in neodymium is a little bit below or like 20. So it's again moving to smaller volume. Neodymium is more strongly correlated yet. And I remind you that neodymium has no observed collapse. And so the reason for showing the last two view graphs was to show that in terms of the dynamical mean field, at least for the same structure, FCC, the results look fairly similar with an evolution as you go to the heavier rare earths of being more strongly correlated at a given volume. Now, actually, I'm I only have two more view graphs before I conclude, and this is going to be purely experimental data, but I think it's really fascinating. It's about the praseodymium volume collapse. This just shows some brand new data for the melting curve taken by Iran Dunia et al. 2 years ago, and then this region here is blown up, but this is brand new data by a group at our laboratory, Bruce Baer and company. And what's really fascinating is that they measured the size of delta V as a function of temperature, and they plotted it here from about 300 Kelvin to 700, and it extrapolates linearly, actually roughly to zero around where the melt temperature would be. But we can do something interesting. The Clausius-Clapeyron relation relates the slope of this line, which we know experimentally, to the delta V over the delta S. So combining those two pieces of information, we can plot their data as entropy. And if you do that, you get another straight line. And if you extrapolate back to T equals zero, you get log 9. This is experimental data. And I just note that the degeneracy of the correct Hund's rule ground state for praseodymium is 9, and just as for cerium, it was 6. In this observation of this T equals zero intercept being 6 for cerium has already been noted by Johansson and others. So this is a beautiful consistency showing up in the data. And what it really means pictorially is that if you have a phase diagram like this, at zero temperature, of course, the entropy is all zero, but you've got all kinds of awful things happening down here, crystal field, magnetic order, which is killing off the entropy. But above some temperature, which is still low, let's say 200 Kelvin, what you have is a plateau in the entropy for the localized phase, which is, again, the degeneracy of that Hund's rule moment. And then in the itinerant phase, the moment has been screened or dismantled in some way. Yet you still have an entropy from a Fermi liquid, which is basically proportional to T, and the coefficient is given by the density of states at the Fermi level. So this is right out of Cattell. And so if you plot the difference in the entropy against this phase line, the slope is coming from this, and the fact that you had to extrapolate to T equals zero was to get rid of this term here and actually expose the log 2j plus 1. We're very excited that Sam Weir at our laboratory and Yogesh Vora at the University of Alabama are making designer diamond anvil cells to measure magnetic susceptibility under pressure. They've sputtered little coils on the tips of the diamond and then epitaxially covered it back with more diamonds so that they don't get shorted out. And they have hopes of being able to go through all of these transitions and get the magnetic susceptibility. And if their resolution is such that they can get the temperature dependence and from that get a moment, this is going to be a fascinating additional diagnostic for these materials. All right, so let me conclude with a table, which is just for cerium, but it's an attempt to summarize. As I'd indicated, I tried to organize the talk by comparing the static mean field of the correlated calculations. All right, one of the things I observed was that magnetic order and the moment go together. You either get them or you don't. And so in the gamma phase, you get them, and the alpha phase, you don't. And the real world situation is that all of these transitions occur above magnetic order, so it has nothing to do with magnetic order, and the moment persists. So those explain that differences. Now, it would really be nice to have magnetic susceptibility, which should be Curie-Weiss here for the gamma phase. And then when the moment is screened, it should be small. I put zero. We haven't done any susceptibility calculations yet, but we'd be very anxious to do that. However, the entropy sheds some light on that because the moment that would be buried in the coefficient of this susceptibility would be the square root of j times j plus 1 times a Landé g factor or something. But anyway, the entropy is measuring that same magnetic moment through the degeneracy. And here the failure of the static beam field is the broken symmetry. By breaking the symmetry, it kills the entropy and sends it to zero. In the alpha phase, you have a screen moment, so, and here the entropy is killed by a similar mechanism, so there's no real disagreement. Turning to the spectra, the polarized solution does indeed split those bands apart. You get a lower Hubbard band and an upper Hubbard band. The correlated solutions and experiment show the same dominant features, but I put a faint C here to indicate that you still, in the gamma phase, do have a bit of a Fermi-level resonance. Whereas on the alpha side, these bands coalesced and you get this central feature, which is also much, much stronger in the correlated solution and in the experiment. But again, it has these residual Hubbard side bands, which is, as I've indicated in our calculations, appear to persist up to very large volume. So all in all, these features here are all consistent with the Kondo volume collapse model, and one would have to view it as describing the cerium physics the best. The static mean field picture here is really the one that Johansson and the LDA community verbalize when they talk about Mach transition. And so it is lacking in several areas. But there is one final issue, which I alluded to earlier in the talk, which is that LDA does very well for these itinerant phases. It gives structural, it gives volume dependence of the total energy, it gets subtle structural phase transitions and variations in C over A, and presumably that LDA is weakly correlated. So how is it doing so well when all of these new dynamical mean field calculations and the earlier Kondo volume collapse model are telling us that these itinerant phases are strongly correlated? So I think this is an issue that remains to be solved in the future. It may be something as simple that the LDA gets the interaction between quasi-particles right, but somehow there's the guts of the quasi-particle, there's a binding energy that it gets wrong, and so there's a constant error. But anyway, that's a really fascinating issue that remains to be resolved. And that's all I have. Thank you. I don't know the answer to that. The level of the answer that I would give is the sense that the k-dependence of the self-energy does not seem to be physically important to this rare Earth problem at room temperature. I could imagine... Well, that's... Anybody else? But I would think that the hybridization has gotten huge as you reduce the volume, and that's reflected in the G0 that goes into that impurity model.
Comment on that. I think in a situation where there would be sizable spectral correlations, magnetic correlations, probably the effect you are talking about would be important, and would be narrow when measuring the energy. But presumably here we are dealing, and you emphasize that in your talk many times, we are dealing with a situation in which the temperature range is such that the correlations are very, very short range. And the driving force is really the screen or the screening of the moment. And I think in that case, case nine, or spatial variations are fundamentally important.
It poses the question of whether you rather overestimate or underestimate the correlation effect. If you go from B infinity of the k-independent dimension to one dimension, then you go from the matter that you have matter estimation to one dimension, then you always go to one information, to which might rather indicate the opposite behavior, the correlation would rather increase if you take case of the
there's two comments. One is that the beta phase, which is a magnetically ordered phase, although with a different crystal structure, is not far away. And so if you're looking for magnetic interactions as a clue to whether there could or could not be field dependence, you just might want to remember that there is a magnetic phase, you know, right in there in the phase diagram, which is actually a nuisance for people who want to study this material. And then I wanted to offer a speculation about the LDA doing well for the strongly itinerant phases. And this is just a speculation, but within the framework of the impurity model, there's a great asymmetry between the role of the F0-F1 fluctuations and the F1-F2 fluctuations, which was uncovered, I think, by Louis Lunarsson in the work that he and Kurt Turnhammer did. And the F0-F1 parts are what generate condo-like stuff to kind of first order in perturbation loops that involve hybridization. And the F1-F2 pieces actually create a large contribution to the ground state energy of the model, but they aren't particularly sensitive to whether or not you formed a spin singlet. So it's a fraction of the total ground state energy in the impurity model that actually has to do with the quenching of the moment. And so one could wonder whether perhaps the total energy that the LDA is calculating might not be pretty good, and it just has trouble catching, at least at the simplest level, that piece of it that involves whether the moments would quench or not. So I always imagine that these various next approximations of polarization-dependent corrections and orbitals and this and that were ways to try to push the theory in the direction of sort of picking out the piece of the energy that was more relevant to the phase transition. And I think they did do better for the pressure in which it...
Well, they enable you to get a transition. Yeah. If you use run-of-the-mill LDA, you would never get out of the alpha phase. But Hartree-Fock would. It's just that LDA threw out Hartree-Fock-like stuff. And the self-interaction correction, LDA plus U and orbital polarization are all ways of putting that physics back in. But it's still no better than Hartree-Fock at a gross level.
Well, if you're correct, you include the functional coupling in your calculation. Now, maybe that doesn't matter so much for cerium and gadolinium as far as the basic global picture is concerned. But I was just going to point out that for gadolinium, the situation might be very, very different. Because as gadolinium, you start with a 4F7 state, and it can be fine. Let's just forget about the Hunslow coupling, but take an effective U, which would be the minimum energy to remove and add an electron. Then that for gadolinium is in fact the F0 state or interval plus 6 times J1, which turns out to be about 12 or 13 electron volts, experimentally measured. But as soon as you add one F electron, or subtract one F electron, that minimum energy goes down to F0 minus J1, meaning that you have a huge sudden change in the effective energy it costs you to make polarity fluctuations in your system. So I was very intrigued by the very high pressure experiments on gadolinium as to whether or not something really dramatic could happen, you know, rather than the simple thing of it could be much more dramatic.
We're working hard on putting in spin orbit and intra-atomic exchange.
Well, this is not even spin orbit. This is just...
We're both. Yeah, I know.
So the Hunslow coupling is a more important thing for our
engineering. If I get a failed fluctuation, then I could...
Yeah, run away.
I could successfully change the U by a walking bump.
By a walking bump, yes. And a huge amount.
Very interesting. Well, it is interesting that... I mean, there's that long range of the series. I mean, there's the collapse in praseodymium F2, and then you don't see anything until F7. So.
Yeah, but that has to do with these kinds of things.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah, in the discussion that you made of the fluctuations in the number of electrons, you discussed it as though, I think your words were, at any given time, at any given site, you'd see an integer number of electrons. And I was trying to figure out to myself, if it had to be like that, again, if I did an impurity model, then I guess I'd have configuration interaction. So perhaps my basis states would still have only integer numbers of f electrons, and I guess if we made a measurement, it would come out even if one or the other. But you don't have any other sites, and you kind of implicitly either have it on this site or that site.
Well, but you do have the valence electrons, so you could have an F0 and an F1 with
the... Okay.
I just didn't think quantum mechanics had half an F electron.
How could I argue with you about that?
Just a general comment. Maybe we shouldn't give too much the impression that knowing magnetic phases when doing the MMT calculation, in principle, of course, the magnetic phases can be investigated with great precision of variables and do all these solutions.
But it's not a problem.
Yeah, the whole problem looking at magnetic phases, the only thing that we are so happy to get the incident in state, the localized state without memory power, that's really the thing wrote in principle.
And moral, I think that this magnetic behavior is so specific because it's T-squared over U,
yeah?
I don't understand why...
getting the magnetic transition,
why?
Actually there are both. Magnetism is going to be overestimated in the universe.
You don't understand.
Why common? Because we don't have to care depend on self-energy.
No, I forgot about broken symmetry.
Yeah.
I just been to a bunch of talks on DCA, so please forgive me. Yeah.
Okay, George.
And the DF interaction is actually very big.
You mean UDF or what?
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's actually very big. Now, you don't. I assume that that's not. At least it's not in yourself.
Nope. The Ds are valence electrons without any correlation.
Yeah.
It's.
Well, it's not the correlation between the Ds, but it's the DF correlation. The DF interaction locally that I would. Might be rather important, especially also in the formation or in the change, in the valence change, shall we say, as you go through some kind of a transition.
So you just mean adding to the UFF, adding a UDF in the quantum Monte Carlo.
Yeah, I know that in some materials, especially in the cases of cerium, also praseodymium, but then more insulating cases, you can actually get conversion.
So if
the exponic state, you might say, is lower energy.
If the FFU is 6 volts, what would the DF be?
Pardon?
If the FFU is 6 volts, what would the DF be?
Of course, it would depend again on the volume.
Yeah.
Which, more so than the FFU does.
Right.
But I would suspect it's around 3 or 4 D.
Oh.
But then you would have another UFF. So here, this is for constrained aviation.
Be careful. With the UFF, to me, means ionization potential minus electronic energy, so making the real transition, taking electrons from one cerium and putting it onto another. Okay? UFD means that you can make an internal excitation, which actually is much lower in energy. And I can imagine that could really contribute to your self-energy Yeah, what's the D bandwidth though?
Well, I think that for these large volumes, probably your D bandwidth is not that terribly big. I don't know.
Well, the goal was 1 over R to the L plus L prime plus 1. So the. So it's not.
I think it's no bigger than about 3 or 4 electron volts have those very large volumes, perhaps.
Another way to think about that, if you look at Johansson's scheme for calculating rare F electron binding energies, an intrinsic part of it is that you have local screening.
That's exactly what he does.
And so that's, in a certain way, takes account of this interaction. Now, you might say, well, maybe I should make it dynamic, which would then be a model.
That's basically what I'm saying.
And if you did that, one idea you might have is that you could then see another peak in the spectrum, which would carry some spectral waves. So in fending off arguments like you made in the past, what I tried to do is to say, well, when we look at the spectrum, we don't see that extra peak, which sort of tells you that the way the dynamics works is more towards the static kind of Johansson picture, where you just have parameters that have been renormalized to account for the interaction. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's a low-line argument that we would have made.
With no clinic.
Hey, now I have a problem.